Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Take 2/3 cups of the chia seeds. You pour over about 2 1/4 cup of whatever kind of milk you want. And then you let them sit for 24 hours. Overnight, at least 24 hours is even better.
And then when you're ready for breakfast, there's your meal. Daniel Orr shows us 2 make-ahead breakfast recipes that will streamline your day. From Harvest Public Media, we'll meet a group of farmers who are trying to learn more about keeping their soil healthy. Then why one organic farmer has chosen to not bother with becoming USDA certified organic. We look at the gaps in the federal summer food program. And one suggestion for how to revive the American bison population is to put bison on more menus. Taking a look at food headlines from the week, it's Mark Chilla.
Late Thursday night, the U.S. Senate agreed to a bill that sets a standard for labels on genetically modified food. But as Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports, it's still a food fight.
Both sides of this fight agree that there should be labels. That's because the overwhelming majority of consumers say they want to know if there are GMOs in their food. Trouble is, the bill passed last night would override a tough law that requires mandatory labeling of GMO foods that went into effect last Friday in Vermont. That state's Senator Bernie Sanders argued that his state has already set the standard.
Pick up a package of M&Ms, and there it is right now on the label. There it is, 5 words, naturally processed with genetic engineering.
The bill that passed the Senate isn't as stringent as Vermont's. Food companies can place wording on food packages, use a QR code, or offer a phone number for those wanting more information. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
Global food waste numbers are grim, Annie. 1/3 of all food in the world is wasted, while 800 million people around the globe remain undernourished. Up to $940 billion a year is lost, as well as 1/4 of all water used by agriculture each year. But the momentum to curb food loss and waste has grown in recent years. Many countries, including the U.S., set ambitious food waste reduction goals, though they lacked common definitions, reporting guidelines, and the knowledge of exactly where and why food was being lost. Until now. Last month, a coalition led by the United Nations and the World Research Institute announced a global set of standards to measure food loss and waste, with the goal of cutting global food waste in half by 2030. The Food Loss and Waste Accounting and Reporting Standard is a set of reporting requirements to better measure, report on, and manage food loss and waste for both countries and private companies. Perhaps the biggest accomplishment of the standard is to define wasted or lost food as food no longer available for human consumption. So even if food is still usable for compost or animal consumption, it is still considered waste under the new standards. This will help improve food security, Robert von Otterdijk of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations said to Marketplace. The private sector is embracing the new standards as well, including the Consumer Goods Forum, which represents more than 400 of the world's largest retailers and manufacturers from 70 countries. Though the new standards are voluntary, many countries, including the U.S., have declared their intent to use them. And you know what they say about corn? It should be knee-high by the 4th of July. Changes in how we farm means that isn't necessarily true these days. Corn plants are growing taller than that. In the past few decades, seed companies have created corn hybrids that farmers can plant earlier in the year in cooler weather. Back in April, the USDA predicted Indiana would grow about 3% more corn this year than last. Purdue University's self-described corn guy, Bob Nielsen, says the crop is still on track for that increase, despite a rainy start to the season that delayed some planting. He expects most of the corn will start flowering by late July, which is pretty close to normal. Find these articles on our website and even more stories at twitter.com/EarthEats.
Mark Chilla is Earth Eats news guy. Never change, Mark.
Right back at you, Annie.
Generations of tilling and planting on some land have left soil and many farm areas in poor shape. As Logan Layden reports for Harvest Public Media, many farmers worry that their livelihoods are in danger.
The superstitious Indians hated the plow. They said that plowing turned the earth upside down and ruined everything.
As this old documentary from Oklahoma TV station WKY about the Dust Bowl shows, the American Indians were right to be concerned.
The spring of 1934 was dry. Farmers had planted their wheat in the dust that fall and waited. But the winter had passed without snow. Spring began with no clouds, no rain.
The Dust Bowl was about to begin. The natural prairie had been plowed away. Drought set in. The wind did the rest. More than 800 million tons of topsoil blew away in a single year. In the decades since, farmers have planted trees, irrigated crops, and changed the way they plow to prevent another Dust Bowl, but they kept plowing, kept tilling their fields.
Tillage is incredibly intrusive. Tillage is an intrusive tool.
Ray Archuleta is an agronomist with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Part of what he does for a living is dig holes and look at dirt to chart soil health across the country.
To me, it's a national crisis. And a lot of people say, well, you're being overdramatic. I say, well, get in the vehicle with me and let's go. When you drive, Logan, through the whole country, it's very sad to see that our land is very, very diminished.
Plowing up the ground can help farmers deal with pests or control weeds, but Archuleta says tilling also excites bacteria that eat the organic matter in the soil plants thrive on and destroys root and worm pathways that allow moisture to penetrate the ground. Over time, the dirt dies, and only more land and more fertilizer keep crops growing. Jordan Shearer, who owns a farm near Slapout, Oklahoma, and works for the State Association of Conservation Districts, puts it more simply.
The problem is we're creating a desert environment by plowing the damn ground.
The solution? Researchers suggest farmers of all kinds stop tilling and rotate their cash crops with cover crops, assortments of local plants that cover the field and restore organic matter into the soil when they die. Think of it as large-scale composting. Ray Archuleta calls it farming in nature's image.
It's about mimicking nature and understanding the ecology. So it's no-till with the covers, with the animals. It's all of it as a system.
Shearer, the Slapout farmer, says moving away from that natural system is killing Oklahoma's once fertile soil.
These soils, when they were first broken out 100 years ago, probably had anywhere from 3 to 5% organic matter. Most of them are down to 1%.
When was your last rain out here? Last water.
I meet Shearer and dozens of other Oklahoma farmers in a field in western Oklahoma near a blip on the map called Leedy. They're here for a State Conservation Commission workshop on the benefits of rotating no-till wheat with cover crops.
Now Tanner's got a jar here of the mix that we planted.
Jimmy Emmons owns this land and is talking to his fellow farmers about the cover crop of broad-leafed plants here.
We've got cowpeas, 8 pounds per acre, mung beans, 6.
Emmons' farm is used as a model as the Conservation Commission tries to spread the idea of switching to better farming practices. The attendees are all eager to learn more, like Roger Oman, who just planted his first cover crop.
Well, you know, I've been watching Jimmy. You know, he's a neighbor of mine, and my wife says, I want something green out there this summer instead of dirt. Yeah. So I said, okay, we'll try it. And it's 40 acres, and I said, shoot, we'll try it, and we'll start playing with the deal. Who knows? That might be all we do in the future. You know?
There are hurdles to making the move away from traditional farming. New equipment is expensive, and the transition takes time. But these farmers see the need for change.
We'll load up on the buses, and we'll go to the last stop.
Still, old habits die hard. Archuleta says right now only about 25% of U.S. cropland is no-till and less than 1% have cover crops. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Logan Layden.
This story originally aired last year. You can see the article and the pictures that go with it at eartheats.org. Our hectic morning routines sometimes don't allow for a significant amount of cooking time, but that doesn't mean you can't have a healthy, hearty breakfast. Daniel Orr has recipes for that. They both take a little extra work the night before.
This is steel-cut oats, and they take a lot longer to cook. And a lot of people, and a lot of times, it will stick to the bottom of the pan. You know, you're there in the morning, and it takes 45 minutes to cook, so you don't have time. So I'm going to show you an easy way. What we do here is I have got a pan on. I'm going to put a little bit of oil in the pan, and then add about half a cup of oats, depending on how many people you're cooking for. And what we're going to do is just toast those a little bit. Well, what this does is it brings out kind of a nutty, smoky flavor. And you want them just to get a little bit brown and start to smoke a little bit. And they'll taste much more kind of nutty and smoky. Okay, so we let these toast. We're going to cover them with about an inch of water. All right, we're going to bring that back to the fire, bring that up to a boil. While we're waiting for that to boil, we're going to add some orange zest. And that's going to bring a little more intrigue and mystery to your oats. And once it boils, I'm going to add just a little bit of vanilla. Now, you want it to boil first because if you add this right now, a lot of the flavor will just go up into the air. So we're going to bring that to a boil. And the great thing about this recipe is you do it the night before. You just do this, you leave it on the stove overnight, and your steel-cut oats will be perfect in the morning. All right, so we've come to a full boil here. Going to add just about a teaspoon of vanilla, give it a good stir, bring it back to a rolling boil, and then just turn off the heat. And that's all there is to cooking breakfast.
The next morning, just reheat it. Daniel finished it off with some brown sugar, toasted pecans, and a bit more orange zest. And you might notice that you don't need too much sugar because you have all those other goodies in there. Here's another idea for make-ahead breakfast.
Those are chia seeds. Cha-cha-cha-chia. Seriously, that's what they are. Okay, and basically what you do is you take 2/3 cups of the chia seeds, you pour over about 2 1/4 cup of whatever kind of milk you want. If you want to go vegan, you could do an almond milk, you could do a soy milk, or you could use coconut milk in this too. So that gives you another option. Coconut milk's going to be a little richer, has that nice fattiness to it. And then you let them sit for 24 hours, overnight at least. 24 hours is even better. And what you come up with is this kind of rice pudding looking mixture. So staying with our kind of a vegan theme, we're going to use the agave to sweeten it. We're going to add just a little touch of lemon juice. And the lemon is going to give it that little acid kick to just give our flavor complexity. You want to hit all those different parts on your tongue. You can add some vanilla extract or almond extract if you like. You can put a little pinch of salt in this too. Then we're just going to dish this out, and what's going to make it look a lot better is the fresh fruit we put on top. So we're going to put a few kumquats on here, again getting that citrus flavor, a few blueberries, and a few blackberries, and then put a little green mint on there, and that's as simple as it is.
He says it sort of looks like rice pudding, to give you an idea of what we're looking at. Or, you know, just go to the website and see the pictures, where you can also find the recipes. That's always a good bet. EarthEats.org is our little corner of the internet. Coming up, Michael Hicks of Living Roots.
Our methods of harvesting are much more organic. They're not. It's not like you're just taking big tractors and harvesting with tractors. We're harvesting with people, and so we can plant in smaller spaces.
He uses the word organic, but his farm is not certified by the USDA, and that's just fine by him. We'll hear why. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Summer food programs kicked off in Indiana in June. Many low-income children rely on these USDA food programs when school's not in session, but an estimated 80% of Indiana's children expected to use the federal program may not actually be able to. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan visited a USDA summer food service program in Indianapolis and reports on efforts to reach children in need.
On the west side of Indianapolis, Stout Park boasts a playground, splash pad, a picnic area, and a large green space. Chris Lavalvo brought her two small children.
being that their 4 and 5 peanut butter and jelly is their most important thing. Just it's very healthy. Things that we wouldn't, sometimes I just can't afford to do at home. It's always nutritious, and they get a choice, and that's what I like the best.
The federal summer food program requires distribution in areas where at least half of the children qualify for free and reduced meals. Here in Wayne Township, about 75% qualify. But approximately 80% of Indiana's low-income children won't be able to connect with the federal program this summer. The Indiana Department of Education, or DOE, heads efforts to recruit sponsors like schools, faith-based organizations, and parks to host feeding sites. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Glenda Ritz says one challenge is letting people know where these distribution centers are.
And so we have to make sure that we get the word out to as many families as possible to be sure they continue to have that kind of food during the summer months. It's just so important. As I said before, you know, you feed the body, you feed the mind.
The DOE is running more ads this year, and it has a new text message campaign. But Ritz says even if they reach more people, they still have another problem, transportation. And it might be the most complicated. With commuting and other lifestyle changes, a growing number of low-income children now live outside the neighborhoods that qualify for federal assistance. Lucy Melcher works for No Kid Hungry and says the food service program needs a makeover.
It's really operating in the same way that it was more than 40 years ago. And as we know today, communities in poverty look very different than they did in 1975.
On top of this, transportation can also be an issue within qualified neighborhoods.
We need to make sure that we have a summer meals program that can reach children no matter where they live during the summer months.
Melcher wants to see Congress rework the program through the Child Nutrition Act. Her group is urging lawmakers to consider easing constraints and giving sponsors more ways to administer the program.
The challenge is that overall this program just does not allow for the kind of flexibility and innovation that organizations on the ground need.
But innovative ideas are happening at another site in Indy's Wayne Township.
This is our second year back.
A few years ago, Child Nutrition Director Sarah Gazarowski decided to take $30,000 from her budget and rehab a school bus to bring the summer meals to new sites. She was able to add another bus last year.
Each bus does a couple hundred meals a day. And our second bus right now has a new route, and so it's dropped from our normal count, but it's reaching an area that really needs us down there, so it's just going to take time to build that up.
Michelle Strong and her three children sit on long benches that line the inside of the food bus that's parked in a West Side apartment complex.
It makes a lot of sense. You know, some people, to be honest, some people don't have food at home, so this is a chance for them to come down here and eat.
Gazarowski says she still wishes she could do more.
I think sometimes the fact that we don't have an option to take it. It would be wonderful if the program allowed us, like kids, to sign up, that we know they're in need and we could get the food to them, you know, like what I call meals on wheels, for summer lunch.
The federal government requires the reauthorization of the Child Nutrition Act every 5 years. Both Congress and the Senate have passed versions that include the Summer Food Service Program and are working on a compromise. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan in Indianapolis.
This story comes from IPB News, Indiana Public Broadcasting's statewide network. Jill Sheridan posts her stories at WFYI.org. Earlier in the show, we talked about putting a label on foods made with genetically modified organisms. There's another food label some farmers have thoughts about, USDA certified organic. Reporter Jamie Ordonez has a story of a farmer who embraces the organic ideal but dismisses the label.
Living Roots is a farming eco-village in French Lick, Indiana. Home to about 10 farmers at a time, they produce tons and tons of produce each year. So what exactly is organic? The dictionary says it's, quote, of, relating to, or derived from living matter. And Michael, farming manager of Living Roots, says,
when you're organic, you're trying to, like, work with the land and you're trying to work with nature versus, like, conventional. Conventional is really trying to control nature.
The USDA, however, only lets you call yourself organic if you go through their certification process. But to Michael and the rest of Living Roots, you don't have to be certified to be organic. So when Michael or I just say organic, I mean the non-USDA kind. If I'm talking about the USDA definition, I'll say certified organic. Since technically we aren't supposed to be using the big O word, Michael plays with terminology.
What's a word you'd use to describe your farm?
I mean, most people just say chemical-free or some people say natural, but natural is really even more deflated than organic, so I don't really like using natural. Yeah, most people say, or eco-grown, you can use that term, whatever.
So to him, it's not so much the term that's important, but rather the process the farmer uses.
That's as much of part of being organic in my mind as not using chemicals or whatever. It's the process and like how much petroleum you're using, the sustainability of it.
Michael wasn't always dedicated to this lifestyle. He co-founded Living Roots 3 years ago after completely changing his life path. First, he got a business degree and then got a job in an industry that he now loathes, big corporate chemical.
And then I was just like really started asking the question of like, what's my bigger purpose here? What's going to fulfill me in my life? And like, it's not sitting at a desk doing being an accountant for a big chemical corporation that I was working for. And then so I just started asking the question and it took a long time.
And now his professional life is completely chemical free. This idea of life fulfillment is something Michael and the rest of the Living Roots community focuses on, and it stretches beyond farming.
We'll have like a lot of artist people come and creative kind of people that don't want like a corporate work environment, and they can do their own thing. So it is about creating an umbrella here that where people can do what they love to do.
And as for Michael, he knows he's found his place at Living Roots. Back to this whole organic thing. So they believe in this completely. They farm organic, live organic, everything organic, but they choose not to be certified. Here's why.
You have to write down basically like all your pounds of harvest for like each vegetable, and you have to write down your sales of harvest for each vegetable, and you have to write everything you put in your fields, and it just goes a little bit too far.
Michael knows this firsthand. He used to be certified, but stopped because he became disenchanted with the process.
Well, there's a lot of loopholes within the regulations where you can, you know, less organic parts of the process can be allowed and still be certified organic.
Another reason he turned away from certification is that he believes organic should focus on the soil, but the USDA doesn't even test the soil for chemicals.
I mean, organic really focuses on soil, and it's, you know, when you're focusing on the soil, you can plant in different ways. And we're also like, our methods of harvesting are much more organic. They're not, it's not like you're just taking big tractors and harvesting with tractors. We're harvesting with people, and so we can plant in smaller spaces.
Not being certified hasn't hindered Living Roots' success. They have over 100 families that pick up produce on a weekly basis, sell at various farmers markets, and deliver their produce to local restaurants. So if you can be so successful without being certified, why does the system exist?
I think it's still better to have the system, but it's really set up for large farms. I mean, we grow a lot of food, but we're still a small, like, family-sized farm. And so, yeah, it's set up for, like, you know, shipping organic produce, certified organic produce across the country where you can't meet your farmer. It's like most of our customers, they know our practices are really organic and that's the kind of farming we do.
For WFIU's Earth Eats, I'm Jamie Ordonez.
This story was produced in collaboration with Indiana University's Media School and Sarah Neal Estes. Now to Colorado, where massive bison herds used to be a staple of the Great Plains. That is, until we almost hunted them out of existence. Now, with a new designation as the country's national mammal, bison ranchers argue that if we truly want to bring the animals back, we have to eat them. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon explains.
Greg Knott is an accidental bison rancher. He didn't grow up on a farm. But 4 years ago, his wife Tammy saw a herd of grazing bison on her way to Wyoming from their home in suburban Colorado. She knew then she wanted to raise the animals.
How long did it take you to accept that we were going to do this?
I was pretty opposed to it at first because my background is in IT.
And so the couple pivoted from computers to bison. Today, the Knotts have a small herd on a wide, grassy piece of prairie a few miles south of the Colorado-Wyoming border. We're out here behind a 6-foot-tall barbed wire fence, tossing apple slices to the furry beasts. They take turns rolling around in the dirt, sending a small dust cloud into the sky.
Their head movements are very exaggerated, and you get your hand in the wrong place, and you get a horn. So you just don't do that.
Yeah, we have people asking, can we pet them? And we're like, oh, please don't.
But what the animals lack in calmness, they make up for in the price of their meat. See, bison is in demand at restaurants and grocery stores, no longer relegated to novelty status, or only pigeonholed to Wild West-themed eateries. Yet the Knotts say they didn't just get into the business to make a buck. Part of their desire is to get the animals back on the land they historically roamed.
In order to save this animal, we're going to have to eat them.
And I call it market-based conservation.
That's Dave Carter, the director of the National Bison Association. In a rare lightning strike of congressional cohesion, lawmakers named the animal America's national mammal this spring.
I think the goal of this is to put bison on a stage that allows all of us that are connected with this animal to tell the story of bison.
Part of the designation is purely conservation. The coalition that pushed for it to be named the national mammal included Native American groups and wildlife advocates. But another flank of the group is made up of business people. They say by convincing consumers to buy and eat bison, it creates demand. More ranchers raising them means more animals out on the plains.
My job these days consists primarily of reaching out to folks to build the herds and get more people into bison ranching. And that's going to bring these animals back to more and more acres of rangelands and pastures across the country.
Now, bison ranching isn't new in the U.S., but those in the industry want to latch onto this moment in the spotlight. The early 2000s brought a lull to the bison market. Some call it a bison bubble, where ranchers were more focused on breeding and selling the live animals to other aspiring ranchers, rather than investing in infrastructure to process and market their hides and meat. Since that bubble burst, Bob Dineen's built this bison slaughter facility in Brush, Colorado. Bison carcasses move along a chain hung upside down by their legs.
The young bulls that are our prime product weigh somewhere around 1,100 pounds live.
Dineen's company, Rocky Mountain Natural Meats, kills and butchers upwards of 200 animals a day here. The meat from this facility supplies restaurants owned by Ted Turner, the nation's most well-known bison rancher, and even a large retailer like Costco. Their hides are shipped off to be tanned and organs are boxed up to be processed for pet food.
These would be individually wrapped tongues, and those are testicles or Rocky Mountain oysters, and there's a good market for those,
I bet.
Dineen says no matter how high demand climbs for the meat, bison will always remain a niche product.
It's very important that producers are able to be profitable raising bison. And that's kind of our focus, is to try to push that profitability back to the rancher.
Because that kind of market-based conservation, Dineen argues, is one way to put more of the national mammal back on the land. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Even more audio, video, and print stories at harvestpublicmedia.org. Thanks to Luke and Peggy and all the other reporters at Harvest. Thanks also to Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, and Daniel Orr. Earth Eats executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. And the best support of all is from you, tuning in every week. Thanks for being here, and I look forward to next time. I'm Annie Corrigan.